Hi, today's May 7th, 2016. This is MobiNews Podcast number 159, The Rise of Free VPN and Ad Blocking. I'm Todd O'Gossord, my good friend John Westfall, and today, and I'm going to try not to mispronounce his name, Akeem Nazel. No, it's Don. It's Don Sorsinelli. And I think I called him Sorsinelli or something last time. And you have a favorite name, right? Favorite mispronunciation of your name?
Yeah, I do. I told you, you didn't even come close the last time. The best one goes back all the way to my junior high school years when a substitute teacher called me Cicilline.
Which I like.
Yeah, I got hungry, actually. I remember those days when Cicilline was actually sold, and that immediately made my appetite kick in.
At any rate, Don, we asked Don back because I needed some free enterprise IT advice, and Don's the guy. So, Don, where do you work? What's your company?
I work for a company that is headquartered in Connecticut, but I work out of our Waltham, Massachusetts, Boston area office. The company is Tango, we're known primarily for telecom expense management. Been doing that for a number of years. But we've also expanded into, thanks to mobility, we started with fixed telecom, now obviously mobile telecom. We provide a number of services. We're even moving into, from an expense management perspective, while we've been primarily telecom, we're actually moving with new product lines into IT expense management as well.
Really?
We're looking beyond just fixed and mobile for expense management. We're looking at cloud, obviously. Becoming a bigger factor. So it's a fascinating business. I came in basically at the time on the mobility side,
right?
Based on my experience, and but I've been involved with obviously more, not just the technology, but obviously the business side with expense management and the likes. And I've learned a lot. It's been a pretty fascinating experience.
That's pretty cool. And by the way, you know, we've met in person, of course, but I've never met you in your home area. But GTE used to have GTE Labs out in Waltham, and so I've actually been in that area.
Yeah, that our corridor, that stretch, people who know the Boston area know the 128 corridor is still pretty big. I remember in the 90s, it was like Silicon Valley East along Route 128.
Oh, yeah,
with all.
Yeah.
And it's still, as a matter of fact, it's blossomed back again from there's a stretch. Again, people who are familiar with the area know Burlington through to Lexington and into Waltham is just littered with high tech and a lot of not just the traditional tech companies, but a lot of emerging in biotech too.
Well, back in the mid-90s when I passed through there to get to GT Labs, I used to work for GT back then, I remember seeing a lot of the big boys there. Actually, DEC was, you know, they're kind of on the way down, but they were still there. And I think I saw an Oracle office, kind of a big Oracle building there, even though I know they're not based there. So, yeah, there are a lot of people on the road from Boston to Waltham.
One of our favorite stories, like I said, there's this big highway. Route 95 actually shares with 128. It's commonly referred to as Route 128. But you've got this big highway, and on one side was Power Builder, and on the other side was Sybase, the two giant buildings. Yeah. So the joke was when Sybase bought Power Builder, we had this vision of people holding big, hulking PCs running across the highway like Frogger, not trying to get hit as they make their way across to the new building. And it still is. As a matter of fact, you said Oracle. There's actually Oracle, I think, owns three buildings, three huge office buildings right there on the highway, side by side by side now.
Yeah.
So big presence, yeah.
Yeah, and didn't IBM buy Sybase later on?
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, you know, it's been, like I said, the other interesting thing is you've seen logos change quite frequently on buildings along that stretch. They should just have basically some sort of electronic signage, like advertising signage, so they could just change the logos between buyouts, acquisitions, you know, it's rebranding. It's constantly, as a matter of fact, what had been a building used by SAP recently now is Samsung Pay. So the logos changed there. Obviously, what had been Nokia had a big office presence actually in Burlington, and Microsoft is moving in the area. We had seen there was a large presence in Cambridge, the New England Research and Development, or NERD, facilities. they've kept the research and development there, but they've now taken over what had been Nokia space. And now there's a big Microsoft logo across that building in Burlington. So never a dull moment. The signage is always changing. It's worse than Vegas with all the lights and flashing and everything else.
Well, same thing, different headliners too. You know, all the big names that nobody outside of the tech world knows, they all cycle through, and getting tickets is hard, and, you know, there are little wedding chapels here and there. It's the Vegas of the Northeast.
It is. It truly is.
Okay. So today I asked Don here to join John and me because there's been a, I think, kind of a explosion of, well, maybe not an explosion, but sort of an interesting development, free VPNs appearing for browsers, as well as free ad blocking coming into focus again after the big, I'm going to say the big push through last fall when iOS 9 introduced ad blocking as an option in Safari for iOS. And let's see, what else was there? It was one, AdBlock Plus became a... AdBlock Plus browser for Android and iOS became available. And also, oh gosh, what's the one I use in Chrome? There was a Chrome UOrigin, which does ad blocking. And Don's an IT, you know, enterprise guy. So I thought I'd ask his opinion on what's going on there. And John works for a large organization, a university also. So get his take for the end user perspective. So the first one I wanted to bring up is Opera. So Opera, and John and I kind of discussed this earlier. Opera added a free VPN component to its web browser, adding to the free ad blocking in the developer edition. And what's interesting is that the ad blocker part, at least, is now a default part of the, not default on, but, you know, available in the Opera production browser. So let's start with ad blocking, because I assume that's less controversial in the enterprise space. So what's the deal? What's your take of ad blocking in enterprise space, Don? I really haven't discussed this with folks I know in the enterprise IT world.
I'll tell you where the difference, I think, comes in. And first off, when you said Opera and I think of enterprise, I usually think, oh, one of those things that that gets installed additionally so IT doesn't want it on anybody's machines.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. That's a good point.
Yeah, but I think one of the changes that you see coming in, and it's important to always remember, what I just jokingly refer to as something that's always very important. It's from an IT perspective, it's usually what exists versus what somebody's trying to put on a machine. Mm-hmm. When things start to become native or built into browsers, there's a greater chance that, number one, IT won't care or sometimes won't even know. So there's a better chance that they might possibly be used. It's always when you get into the installation of additional components that, depending on IT policies, depending on how hardware's set up, how hardware's monitored, that it may not even be allowed to happen. So I think the change here that you're starting to see is the for lack of a better term, the built-in component may be a change, may be a factor for greater usage. As far as ad blocking is concerned, you know, I think we joked before the show we started recording. I think the only company that would really have an opinion on ad blocking from an IT perspective is an IT department that works for an advertising agency. I mean, most IT organizations I work with aren't necessarily directly concerned with ad blocking. The risk from a security perspective is low. There is a possibility of some problems, but it's low. And usually, since most organizations nowadays at least have some sort of, you know, we're virus scanning, malware detection, things like that, it's not as big an issue. I think the bigger issue gets into when we'll talk a little bit later on about VPN and how that is or more importantly sometimes isn't handled by IT departments as far as what I've seen.
Yeah, you're right. So for example, you know, in my day job, I couldn't install any software. And in fact, not only could I not install software, sometimes I couldn't even update software I already had. I had to wait for either, you know, the enterprise push for, you know, the Windows stuff, that sort of thing. Or if it was a specialty software I had installed, like Esri, you know, ArcGIS Pro or something, I'd have to ask for, you know, somebody to come in and you know, temporarily have administrative power so I could run the update. So, yeah, Opera is probably not going to be a player in either the free ad blocking side or the VPN side in an enterprise. At least I don't know any enterprise that runs Opera as their browser. Except maybe Opera.
One of the things, though, that I was thinking about with ad blocking, since I live in a extremely vertical sort of niche space of academia. And we also do not have the most up-to-date software on the planet, and that textbook publishers build something in 1990, and they figure that can last for the rest of their lives. And I've noticed a few times running AdBlock, because I have the AdBlock extensions that I mostly turn on just to see what they do and what they're going to block or not block. I've come across a couple of older sites that just don't render properly. However they were coded up, they don't work right because the ad block is turned on. And I would think in some of the more niche markets like education, you might have that becoming a bigger problem for IT because they you know, they get a call one day that just says, hey, this website isn't working anymore. And you don't know if it's the website died or the ad blocker's blocking it or a little of both.
Why do you think a website doesn't render correctly when ad blocking is turned on? I mean, I can understand if it's a, you know, it's a news like a CNN or something, but... You know, for an educational site.
Probably because it was never coded properly in the first place. A lot of the stuff I see, in fact, one of the things I get so frustrated and I've ranted on in this podcast in the past is that basically professors and teachers should not look to the education service provider companies for their solutions because most of the time they're replicating something that you can get from Microsoft, Apple, or Google, and you'll get a much better product from them that everyone can access. But for some reason, we've kind of been conditioned in education that, no, you go with the company that's been recommended by your curriculum supervisor or something like that. And those companies, since they have less users, they don't fix things as quickly. They don't update things as quickly. So I try to convince my colleagues. In fact, often I'll have a conversation with someone and they'll go, you know, I use this piece of software that the last major update was 5 years ago and it just isn't working right. So, well, you know, you can do that on Google Forms, you can do that with, you know, Office 365 or any of those. And they just look at me astounded, like they didn't even think of that as an option because it was just not something they had thought of to go outside the education market.
Right. Yeah, no, I do agree. The other, you know, it's interesting. The other, we were just talking about all this in rendering, and at times I found, forget advertising when it's blocked, but advertising when it exists can cause problems rendering, especially with a lot of the mobile browsers.
Yeah.
You know, over the years, that's been, yeah, it's funny. It's the biggest problem I seem to come across, I think, John, you hit upon it, is not necessarily that it's coded incorrectly, but it's coded for 1995 or, you know, and it's now as browser technology, rendering techniques, things like that. It's coded for scenarios that aren't really relevant anymore. And obviously, like you said, ad blockers for many people, that wasn't even a thought back then. So it can be a problem. It can still be a problem running an ad blocker. Obviously, the benefits are there, but it's always the when I do this, cross my fingers. And John, you're right. There's some sites I would go to if I had an ad blocker running. I would probably turn it off before I know the sites up front that would probably be a disaster if I tried to render them.
Yeah, exactly.
And I should note, you know, I took a lot when I was writing for Extreme Tech. I did a three-part series on ad blockers, and I took a lot of heat because, you know, people were saying, you know, quite rightly, that a lot of sites, including Extreme Tech that I wrote for, depended on ads for a revenue stream and that sort of thing. And, you know, I was killing their revenue stream and so forth. And I should also note, to Ziff Davis's and Extreme Tech's, you know, they were nice enough to let my articles go through and pay me for it, even though they knew they might cause a hit when people start turning on. But the reason people are using ad blockers is because for, you know, every site that you go to that should get the revenue from you for showing ads to you, there are a lot of sites that, holy cow, you know, you're only going there once because you click a link in Google News or something and a bazillion ads pop and you can't even see it on your screen. And I mean, not pop-ups, but, you know, there's just a whole bunch of them and it's not even rendering the news you want to read. Right. So what I do is I just have ad blockers turned on by default. And as I get comfortable with a site, or if I'm already comfortable, like if it's ZDNet or TechMeme or something like that, I just turn off the ad blocker for that site, per site basis.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. The first company or organization or person that comes with up with ad blocking technology that effectively allows for whitelisting or blacklisting on a per site basis, whether or not you're going to run the ads, would be a winner in my mind, because where I most like to use ad blocking are those sites. You just hit it where you turn it on and you can watch the lights in the room dim by having to render 27 flash ads, yeah. And it's on one site. And yeah, it's the one time where I wish before I go to some sites, I'm like, geez, I should turn on an ad blocker. Oh, and it'll probably take 5 seconds for this page to load versus 5 minutes.
If you use Google Chrome on your desktop or notebook, there is a free add-on called uBlock Origin that I use that allows you to do a per site whitelisting. And it's really easy. You literally go to a site, you decide, okay, this site is okay. I'm going to turn off ad blocking here forever. You just click on the little bug in the top right hand corner and you just click the off on button to off. And from now on, that site will be whitelisted.
Well, that's it. You just changed my mind. That's it. I'm gone. I'll see you guys later. Bye. I have to go turn on that. That's perfect. I mean, again, I agree. When you talk about that, there's almost that moralistic side to using ad blocking. And there are sites that I obviously understand their revenue models. And I appreciate they use it, I would say, with the proper mindset. They don't abuse advertising. And I'm more than willing to always support those kind of organizations, those kind of companies, those kind of individuals. It's, like I said, the sites that you know, and unfortunately, those tend to be some of the biggest link baiting sites typically on the internet as well. They're just trying to get you there so that 15 ads that are embedded into a page will appear in your browser. And those are the ones I have no problem with saying, sorry, block, or don't even visit anymore, some of them.
Yeah. And my suggestion, and this is not a recommendation, this is not me telling you it's the best thing to do, it's just a suggestion for folks. If you use things like Google News or Google Now on your Android phone, and you see these links that say, hey, we think you're interested in this, and you have no idea what this site is, you might want to just have ad blocking turned on by default to see what happens when you click on that link before you decide it's safe.
Yeah, no, I agree there too. The other thing to keep in mind with this when you talk about using mobile is, again, advertising and the time it takes to load and render a whole bunch of images and things like that. It's battery life. We still haven't reached that perfect point with our phones where we're going to have infinite, battery capacity. And I've had browsing days where I've been trying to go through news stories, clicking through, linking, and I can sit and almost watch my battery drain on the device. while I'm watching that drain, I'm feeling the phone get hot and I'm watching the page just load and load and load. And just when I thought it's loaded, then you get the overlay with the HTML that then brings up the ad that covers the whole page from your phone's perspective. And, you got to wait 2 minutes before you can click the X to close that and get back to the actual contents. Yeah. Those are the days when I turn around and say, yeah, never mind ad blocking. I think just browsing, I'm done.
Yeah, and more in the ad blocking side, Opera Mini for Android now includes ad blocking. I was going to ask you, so generally speaking, what do you see the trend is for companies in terms of I assume company provided smartphones, they simply turn off all ability to install software. But what about, what if they have a BYOD kind of policy? Generally for a bring your own device, what's the policy for installing things like Opera Mini on your own phone? I would assume they allow you to do it, but I don't know.
It's a great question, and I think the answer is it depends. there's several layers to this, and I deal with organizations in mobility enterprises at a number of levels. Usually, I'm engaging them because they're finally looking at enterprise mobility management solutions, and why they're doing that is whether or not it's BYOD. It's they need to come up with some sort of strategy that protects their data, protects the devices if they're corporate owned. And nowadays, BYOD is interesting. Everybody talks about that acronym. What's being learned in the industry is there's actually a new, more important acronym coming up. Mm. And that's COPE, which is corporate owned but personally enabled. Everybody thought, and I think the you know, and what we're talking about here actually falls in line with some of it. You know, everybody thought BYOD was going to be this big panacea for enterprises. And a lot of enterprises thought this was going to be the case because they thought, oh, great, we're not going to have to pay for anything.
Yeah.
What you're finding is that BYOD is happening, but it's a smaller part. If you really want to spur your users on to use the devices for business, what you really need to consider is, hey, still going with the corporate ownership model, but finding a way to allow them to use the device for their own personal uses so that they're not carrying two devices and throwing your phone, the business phone, into a bag and never paying attention to it.
Right, right.
BYOD, yes, it's there, but it hasn't been big. In either case, BYOD or Cope, the key becomes protecting the data. And when you talk about what apps are installed and what's allowed, probably the biggest advances there are around, for lack of a better term, containerization of data. And all the enterprise mobility management solutions are pretty much coming up with ways of doing that, where we're segregating your work and personal. Ironically, BlackBerry was doing that with BlackBerry 10 for the 5 minutes that BlackBerry 10 was relevant. They're building it into the operating system. But
it needed a whole 5 minutes? I thought it was more like about 5 seconds.
Hey, listen, I had a stopwatch invalidated, okay? It's interesting because the third-party EMM providers, you know, all around enterprise mobility management, are coming up with their ways of trying to create a separation, a work and a personal side, and doing it such that for two things. Number one, if you want to install your personal applications, fantastic. That data is never going to mingle with your corporate data and vice versa. And there's some clear delineations. The second thing is, if it's a personally owned device and it's a BYOD policy and you leave the company, I don't have to blitz your entire device.
Right.
I can. And it's not just about email. Originally, the thought was it was about PIM, calendar contacts, email right. tasks. Now it's also about this containerization is carrying to corporate data as well, files. Documents, things of that nature. And everybody's pushing, and that's all your EMM providers, the big names, whether it be MobileIron, AirWatch, Mass 360 from IBM, now Intune with Microsoft. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're all about, regardless of your model, whether it's the company providing it or the individual bringing it in, mm-hmm. having this segregation of the data and the applications, so you can do it. That being said, the companies that are doing using EMM feel a little bit more comfortable in allowing you to install an Opera Mini, or for that matter, a Candy Crush Saga. You know, as long as we have policies in place, and as long as we know that the solution, the overall solution, is protecting the integrity of the device in the end. Mm-hmm. So I think as you see more and more of that, you'll see more and more allowance of potentially of third-party browsers. And you can set up an EMM solution with containerization to say you can only browse certain, like, intranet using, and we'll talk about it in a few minutes, VPN. You'll only be able to browse using that and this browser. You know, a particular browser you can restrict down. So you can sort of, you can add multiple layers of control there.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, it's become a lot more sophisticated than it was in the old days when it was all or nothing and they brick your phone and you leave the company.
Right. And the other thing to keep in mind in all of this is we're having this conversation, and when you talk about between phones and we add to, you know, tablets and laptops.
Right, right.
Mobility is the enterprise now. I mean, it is as big, if not a bigger part of the enterprise in many cases than it ever has been. I work with a number of companies where desktop computers are limited to a small number of employees. Everybody's issued something that's mobile. And as we see, these enterprise mobility management solutions are actually turning into platforms that aren't just for your phones anymore. They're not just for your tablets. They support mobility management of OS X. They support mobility management of Windows 10, and they're treating them with the similar, conceptually, the same analogies that they've treated other mobile devices. You know, it's interesting. Microsoft with Intune, you know, you have SCCM, which was always the classic, what we used for, you know, for managing devices in the enterprise, for managing computers in the enterprises. But Intune is actually crossing over into the market of managing those same kinds of devices too. The idea is around your mobile devices versus your desktop.
I just took a look at Intune the other day. I mean, not, you know, as in tried it out, but I was looking at the literature on it, and I was surprised it handles mobile devices now.
Intune is very much Microsoft's entry into the EMM, you know, the enterprise mobility management space. And it's still got a ways to go. They started later than everybody else, but it's catching up pretty fast. I've been really impressed with their work in the last year and a half. But they recognize the same thing. It's all about, you know, the acronyms that you'll hear. Enterprise mobility management really is the blanket for what had been a number of things. Device management, MDM, mobile device management, really talking about configuring and securing the device. MAM, which is application management, being able to push applications, having separate stores, potentially, you know, a corporate store versus the commercial stores, and everything around that. And then you get into mobile content management, being able to make data, documents for collaborative purposes, as well as just from a repository perspective, securing them and making them happen. EMM is all about it. Now, it's really what you – and as I said, by moving them to what had traditionally been considered quote-unquote desktop platforms, which are also being used for obviously mobile devices, laptops, and tablets, and OS X and Windows 10, they're really moving into that space.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, it's not in our show notes because I wasn't going to bring it up, Microsoft had a SharePoint conference this past week, and they announced that the SharePoint – app for iOS is going to be coming out soon, followed by Android, and then followed by something called Windows, I think. Yeah. In that order, by the way.
Yep, I saw that as well. Yeah. It is, I mean, it's you know, there are any of 5 billion articles probably on the internet, a million recordings and podcasts and interviews. Microsoft, the realization is Microsoft is truly becoming a services company. And they recognize the fact that as a services company, you have to serve your customer. And today's customer is not just Windows, you know, and especially in the mobile space. We obviously know that based on the numbers. Yep. And so they're meeting the demand there. And I will say they're doing a pretty good job with their applications and their services across the device platforms. I love using, you know, their applications on Android. I've used them on iOS. You know, obviously I've used them on Windows Phone too, and I've used them on Windows 10 with tablets. And they seem to be getting that. I think everybody is, and it's back to, like you said, what you're talking about, bringing it full circle. Browsers for mobile devices that are adding features that we used to only talk about for desktop devices or, you know, the larger computing platforms. You know, those features are coming to everything. It's, you know, it is truly a device world. It's not the size anymore that matters.
Yeah. You know, you know, you mentioned that a lot of people aren't getting desktops. I haven't had a desktop in my day job in years. I just changed jobs a couple of weeks ago, and my previous job, I had a Dell XPS 13, and my current job, I have a Surface Pro 4. And that's my main computer. That's not, you know, what I carry around, but that's what I go in and I turn on in the mornings and I take the meetings, and it's my only computer.
Yeah. My workspace, at my workplace, I haven't had a, for me, I think it's been about it's probably longer than 15 years from a work perspective. And I think the last desktop I owned personally was about a decade ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, especially now with the power in smaller devices, you know, as long as you've got a good docking solution and, you know, and a nice monitor, it's in the end, it seems to meet my needs.
I do. And in fact, that's my situation. I had a dock in my old job for a Dell dock, and actually, was it a Dell? I guess it was a Dell dock. And I have the Surface dock for this one. And, you know, it's not that I'm just browsing and using Word. I mean, I've got Esri ArcMap Pro or ArcGIS Pro installed on there. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of data that I need to process some days.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah. Well, the next thing I want, I think I mentioned this earlier, but I just wanted to add it one more time. If you're using Windows Preview, basically the, you know, the preview version of Microsoft Windows 10, apparently, according to Win Beta, Microsoft Edge, its new newish browser, renamed it Internet Explorer, now has AdBlock and AdBlock Plus as an option. So if you want to block ads in Edge, you can apparently now do so if you're running Windows Insider Edition, not the production version. So there's that. Now, the next thing I really was curious about what John and Don has to say. John, I know you have a VPN service that you subscribe to.
Which one was that? Yeah, I'm old school like that. I pay for things. Private Internet Access, PIA is the abbreviation people usually use, but it's privateinternetaccess.com, and it costs about $30 to $35 a year.
Pretty reasonable. And, you know, the thing is that you always hear the experts, the analysts, the pundits say, you know, if you're going to go in Starbucks or you're going to go in some Wi-Fi hotspot zone, you need to protect yourself by having a VPN. But quite frankly, I think the majority of people, including me, have been too cheap to pay for a VPN service, even if it's only $35 a year. Because we're cheap. I was going to try to come up with some other, but that's the way I am.
Embrace that, John, Todd. Embrace the cheapness.
But really, it is an important thing. I mean, you know, I hop on hotspots at Starbucks and other airports and places, and I'm always kind of looking, which is the real one that I'm supposed to connect to an airport. But now, at least if you're running a couple of desktop, at least I haven't seen a free VPN for the mobile space yet. You know, earlier Opera, the desktop version, not Opera Mini, introduced a free VPN option in its developer edition. It's still not in the production version. Seems to work reasonably well, although if you turn on the United States VPN, you know, so that it looks like you're from the U.S., it somehow always tosses me to United Arab Emirates.ae. So that's not quite working great yet. But more interesting, I think, and this is where I was curious what Don had to say, is, you know, we were talking about not being allowed to add software, but I'm going to assume that most enterprises not only allow, but maybe provide Chrome as, you know, an alternate browser to Internet Explorer if you're running on a PC. There's a Hotspot Shield VPN, and some of you may have heard about Hotspot Shield. In fact, I interviewed its president years ago when I was blogging full-time for Think Mobile. And so they're not a fly-by-night company. They've been around for years. I've tried them out on desktop, worked pretty well. But now they have but it was, you know, a little bit heavy sometimes. Not as heavy as some of the other VPN solutions back then. Again, this is like 6-7 years ago. But now they have a free plugin for Chrome. You know, I gotta say that even though I was really locked down, I could generally install plugins for Chrome. So Don, what do you see in the enterprise? Is there a way to block installing plugins in Chrome, and secondly, do people allow it or disallow it if it's not blocked? Do they allow it if it's blocked or encourage it?
He's acting really still if he's thinking.
We may have lost Don. Let me pause. Okay, yeah. So we've got Don back. We had a little technical difficulty. So the question was, what's the policies that you tend to see in enterprises for allowing plugins for especially for Chrome, which has tons of plugins?
Yeah, the policies typically is whether or not Chrome is allowed as a whole. I don't think there's a whole lot of blocking at the add-in level or monitoring for that matter. I think it's interesting that you bring this up because there's probably about 15 different levels to this when it comes to the enterprise and VPN. You know, traditionally, the philosophy of enterprises has been by and large, provide VPN access so that individuals can access internal resources and access them safely. You know, and that's the traditional way we view VPN. The problem that brings up is in a remote mobile world is what am I doing when I'm not accessing the company resources?
Right.
You know, and you know, there's a couple of ways around this. Obviously, by using VPN and blocking split tunneling, you could say, listen, you know, if you come in to get corporate resources, you're getting corporate resources, you're getting nothing else. And the possibility exists policy-wise, you could potentially just force VPN on all the time. Mm. Of course, your corporate network, depending on the number of employees, you know, that's a pretty hefty burden on your networking to make it happen. I think the problem is a lot of companies don't think much about what happens when you're not on the corporate network. You know, it's fine. We want to make sure when you're connecting in, you're connecting in. Great. But what happens, like you said, I'm out and about and I don't need to get it. I don't need to get it file shares. And I'm just out and I'm at Starbucks.
Right.
And I'm using their Wi-Fi. Interestingly enough, I think the mobile world seems to be taking a little bit more of a lead first. The mobile world, as we traditionally have thought of it, with phones, because again, a lot of the device management solutions provide, and the platforms provide, for a lot of configurability to almost force VPN access. And in conjunction with that, and using enterprise mobility management and device management solutions, potentially doing some things around blacklisting and whitelisting of websites unless certain things are used, or, you know, unless you're on VPN or not. So there's been a lot about it. But interestingly enough, most of the companies I have worked with and have talked to, they kind of cross their fingers and hope that, back to virus protection, spyware, malware detection, things like that. That's going to protect the computer, you know, whether it be a phone or a tablet or a notebook, you know, a laptop. They're hoping that that's going to be the protection when they're not on the corporate network. Mm. Of course, that still leaves plenty of vulnerabilities. But the big question, you know, I have yet to see in the company, including company I work for, I've yet to see anybody ever give a best practice that says, use our VPN when you're connecting to our resources. And then when you're not connecting to our resources, we recommend using another VPN solution for just your general browsing. I just haven't come across it. And it begs to ask the question, you know, maybe it's time we start to think about that from an enterprise perspective.
Yeah, that's it. It is an interesting problem because, of course, when you're accessing enterprise resources, you want to have some kind of VPN going in there securely. But then if you're going to CNN, now you're done with work and you're still sitting in Starbucks on your way to the airport or something, and you want to look at, you know, we want to look at a news site or check your personal mail, to use the company's VPN to tunnel back out to the internet, I mean, to go in and come out, is just ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Both of you guys can, I'm sure you remember when we used to sit around years and years ago and listen to people, the biggest concern they had about mobile devices were that they could be virus carriers.
Yeah, I remember that.
But, and remember, that was always the thing, is that right. They could connect to the they download something onto the mobile device and somehow they get it onto the corporate network.
Right.
Well, when you think about it, it's a heck of a lot easier to infect a PC than it is a mobile device.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways, just because of the architectures. And so, you know, as we increasingly are using our more powerful computing platforms, again, going back to more powerful tablets and notebooks, laptops, and we're using them in more and more remote scenarios, rather than, you know, the age old used to be, well, you take your notebook home, you plug it in, you turn it on, you VPN, and when you're done, you turn it off. Those days, you know, aren't there from an enterprise perspective. We have to be treating the heavier, you know, the bulkier equipment, you know, more powerful equipment, just like it was the mobile devices we were so afraid of, you know, 10 years ago. And so maybe it is time to start to think about it. I think the biggest challenge for the enterprise is, how do you come up with a solution and enforce it? And how do you come up with a solution that doesn't break your own back? Like I said, the always on VPN for everybody coming through to do all their browsing, coming through the tunnel, through corporate network, and then back out to the internet. Mm. That would probably bring a lot of companies I know, their infrastructure would be brought to a crawl based on the number of mobile workers. Now, interestingly enough, back to enterprise mobility management, a lot of them are offering their own, which I find interesting. While a lot of companies are heavily invested in VPN solutions that these devices can work with, a lot of the EMM providers have their own VPN solutions. Essentially, they're setting up their own software-based VPN concentrators. And you can point – so you've got your desktops or your notebooks, your traditional devices all connecting through Juniper, for example, or, you know, something like that. But then all your mobile devices are connecting through the EMM platform's VPN functionality. Maybe if you do that combination, you can balance things somehow enough. But I still think the biggest challenge is if the enterprise does what we think might be the safest thing, which is to really mandate always using a VPN when you're not in the office. It's going to be a challenge. It's got to be, because you've either got to have them all come internally, or you've got to come up with something that will be adopted.
Yeah,
you know, it's
a real education problem and a cultural shift problem.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's something we just didn't. I think we kind of took for granted, and we didn't worry about it as much, just because the scenarios didn't dictate it as much. But I think now in 2016, the scenarios do, and it comes down to how secure do we really need to be, and you know, if we need to be that secure, what's the best approach? And I'm sure, just like people are still trying to figure out their mobility strategies with the smaller devices, they're obviously still trying to figure out how to do it now that it's become such a mobile world with bigger devices as well.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't know how much we should worry about things like iOS and Android. I think Android devices we should worry about a lot, by the way, but iOS devices, you know, have had the kind of the glow of security, although we know that can't possibly be true. And having just joined the iPad Pro world, I bought an iPad Pro Junior, as I call it. John earlier bought the full size, biggish one.
Yeah.
You know,
everything with me is bigger.
Yeah. The thing I discovered now that I have iPad Pro Junior with a keyboard, with a smart keyboard, you know, no Bluetooth pairing or anything, is there's some weeks where when I'm at home, I don't turn on my notebook. I just pop up the iPad Pro Junior, and there I am, you know, doing whatever I need to do, generally speaking. So it's a whole different world.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, some of the things that companies are doing too around, you know, we used to, I remember the days of when Citrix ruled the land. Traditionally with virtualization that way and providing access. There's a lot of technology going on right now through virtualization, containerization, containers on the server side level, not like I was just talking containerization with mobile devices and segregating data, but there's also containers you'll hear a lot about. It started in the Linux world, and now you're hearing it across the board. But there's a lot to make desktop apps available through VPN to where it's a virtual, you know, it's again, virtual experience, where I don't have to necessarily give you a full-blown notebook computer to do your work anymore. Yeah. We've definitely – the thing that's made all the difference in the world here is the reliability and the speed of networks for remote users, you know, that you can actually create virtual desktops now that you can access on corporate networks through VPN that are really amazing. It's an incredible, rich experience. You'd swear it's a pure – you know, it's like being there. It's really true virtualization, and so there's a lot of possibilities here. I think a lot of work is being done. I know VMware, obviously with their acquisition of AirWatch as an EMM, is doing a lot of work with what they call the Workspace ONE is one example where you're seeing this the bringing together of their products and their technologies to try and create these kind of, you know, these incredibly rich desktop experiences on a tablet that, you know, in the end you would, you know, it's back to the old, we talk about when, you know, Windows terminals back way back when.
Oh, yeah, forgot ever, about
yeah, remember, yeah, remember the old Windows? Well, guess what? Your iPad Pro and your iPad Pro Junior can make for a pretty good Windows terminal nowadays. Uh-huh. And that's one way, again, if you start to minimize the need for the traditional desktop OS remotely, then perhaps you increase the security. By the way, one last thing on the Android, based on what I've seen, what I've worked with, if we could just find a way to get the world to magically move to later versions of Android, most recent versions of Android, I think a lot of our security problems would be mitigated.
Are you telling me the 7% penetration of Marshmallow is not enough?
It's so frustrating when you see really legitimate, solid efforts to address a situation. And Google has done that. I've seen it firsthand. They recognize it. It took a while, you know, sort of Apple took a while to recognize the enterprise and security. Google's taken it, but they recognize it and they're doing so much work. But the problem is it frustrates me. And hey, guys, once again, it's time for the three of us to go back in the Wayback Machine and remember what it was like with fragmentation and Windows Mobile. Yeah. It's the same problem repeating itself.
Yeah. Except now it's over a billion devices instead of tens of millions.
Yeah, exactly. It's an exponential problem now. But it is. I will say the latest versions, and that's one thing enterprises are also having to wrestle with, back to this whole VPN, back to this whole security, back to all of this, is that they're looking at Android as a viable platform for the enterprise. But the problem is finding solutions that ensure that we're on the right, you know, everybody's on right levels of OSs. So you're starting to see where a few years ago, Android wasn't. I did a lot of work with companies that wouldn't even touch Android. What's happening, at least now, is they're going what I had just described earlier, COPE. They're willing to buy the devices because they know that they're controlling. We're getting devices with latest and greatest versions, mm-hmm. you know. A lot of them buying Nexus devices or, you know, Samsung latest and greatest. And so that they're trying to alleviate the problems. But yeah, it's frustrating. I feel like it's deja vu all over again sometimes when I look at these adoption and fragmentation issues.
And I should note, I only buy Nexus devices now so I can get the, you know, updates as fast as possible from Google. And for the last, I don't know, 6 months since they, you know, switched over to their new philosophy, I think I've been getting monthly security updates on my Nexus 6.
I will say, and I've seen this across devices, I will say while a lot of your vendors aren't getting major OS version updates, the security updates I've seen reaching a lot of the vendors.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'm pleased to see the vendors getting on board with at least the monthly, or in some cases it's been more like I won't say 90 days, it's been more like 45 days.
Yeah.
But even I've seen, I own an Asus Android phone, and monthly I've been getting security updates.
Yep.
So it's good to see that. Now it's just a matter of getting, and I agree with you, I had been for a long time, I had been just a Nexus person for that same reason that, you know, knowing I was going to get the latest and greatest builds, and also having access at times when I wanted to you know, obviously to developer editions and things like that, early access.
Okay. All right. And now that I've had my free consultation from Don. Thank you, Don.
The bill will be in the mail. I'll just have you know.
One last item that has nothing to do with VPNs or ad blocking or enterprise IT, I think anyway, is I just wanted your take on this Microsoft pre-touch sensing thing that, you know, some of our friends have been discussing, that Microsoft Research is demoing, where you can you kind of hover your hand over a Windows phone looking device and it detects where your hand is and sort of does things based on gestures, kind of like Kinect.
Right.
I have my opinion, but I wanted to. Oh, and also, this was apparently completed in 2014. For a never released device, but we're only hearing about it now, 2 years later. So
I beg, it actually did get out a couple of years ago. I remember distinctly, and it wasn't in private groups or anything. It did get out that Microsoft was working on this technology. The problem was that people were more interested in it. Looked like it was going to be another flagship device, because I think it was after that, it was post 1020. Lumia 1020, that this was being talked about, and everybody thought, oh, this is the next flagship. And it turned out it was pretty much just a prototype device that was being used to experiment with this. But yeah, it's, I don't know. The whole thing, it's like, you know, I get pressure sensitive touch. Obviously, we see it now in iOS.
Yep.
I'm sure we'll be seeing it in more Android devices. But I don't know, when you move off the screen completely, how well that's going to work. Yeah. I just have this vision of movement and gestures, you know, and the clash of things and inadvertent gesturing being the request. You know, it's an interesting idea. Don't get me wrong. I love, unfortunately, yet another technology that never really took off for Microsoft and Kinect.
Yeah.
With some, I loved its potential, and I used it at times with the Xbox. But this one, the same thing. It's just I can see there being applicability, but the use cases, it becomes does that get outweighed by the accidental side effects? Yeah. It's a nice idea, but I'd much rather see the more what everybody's doing right now, to be perfectly honest, which is our mobile devices are extensions of our, they're getting more and more accustomed to our voice. I think the real effort has to be done in voice interaction, because that, yes, there's a chance for inadvertent, but it's much less than like I said, waving. If I just happen to pass my hand by my phone and it suddenly starts doing something,
yeah, it starts deleting files.
Yeah, but I think everybody's coming a long way, you know, as far as voice is concerned. I've been incredibly impressed by everybody. I've been impressed by the work with Siri. I've been impressed with the work with Cortana. I've seen Google with, the OK Google functionality. You know, all of that functionality is really getting there.
Amazon Echo.
I really do feel, yeah, with Alexa and everything else, that's been fantastic. And we're supposed to hear from this coming, I think it's Monday, the 9th, we're supposed to hear from the folks that were the original creators of Siri they're doing a press conference, Veev.
Oh, neat.
Yep, they're going to be doing their next generation. They've been doing further work, and they're going to be showing. Nobody knows. This is going to be pretty interesting to see. They're coming out of seclusion to talk about what they're doing. I think that's – when it comes to to moving beyond touch interaction, I think voice interaction is the more natural and less risky approach to it. And, gosh, we're coming so far with it. I can only imagine what the next couple of years hold. I see good things in all of them. I love almost to the point where I recognize its creepiness and how good Google is with the information they provide and the way we can interact, as well as Alexa's pretty amazing too with Amazon and the Echo and other products. Cortana for initiating conversations is fantastic. People don't understand when I'm driving in a car, if I'm using a Windows 10 mobile device, a text message comes in, it starts the conversation and tells me that I've gotten a text from a certain person and asks me if I want it read. And I can have I've actually managed multiple, shouldn't have to go through this, but I've had two or three people texting me simultaneously and never even looked at the phone while I was driving and had carried on multiple text conversations. That's where I see the real power of these kind of interactions with smaller devices moving forward. You know, waving things and getting close. I don't know. I just don't see it.
Yeah. How about you, John? What do you think?
I think that in the theory of the multiverse, that in some spot somewhere in the entire realm of existence, there is a universe where everything went right for Microsoft and absolutely everything that we've seen be vaporware over the last 20 years actually came out. This would have been a great cornerstone in that in some weird way. But I don't see it. I guess I can see why it was ready in 2014 and we don't see it now. If there was a killer use scenario or a killer app, then yeah, I could see it being a great technology, but I don't know what that killer scenario is.
Well, you know, John, I just want to let you know that alternate universe is Hawaii 5.0, where they use Windows phones and Surfi or whatever a plural of a Surface is.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of those. There was for a while a lot of those alternate universes on TV, and then most of them got canceled, which is horrible when your whole universe gets canceled. But, yeah.
It's funny. I still, like I said, where I could see this kind of technology working, it worked well with gesturing in something like as we talked about with Kinect. The other thing is maybe this kind of technology for gestures in air will work well with things like HoloLens and virtual reality and augmented reality. I just don't see it as a substitution for interaction with a phone. I can't see how it doesn't have I keep on trying to find useful scenarios, and then I keep on thinking about all the fails, you know, the faux pas for inadvertent gestures.
Yeah.
And it just,
I think Minority Report has had an undue influence on technological development for the last 20 years.
Well, see, but then again, there it is. That's a scenario on a much grander, larger scale. You're supposed to be working in a large space. Yeah. You know, a 5-inch phone, you know, and where's the value add in doing that? Unless this 5-inch phone suddenly projects holographic images that you're interacting
with. Now, that would be cool.
Yeah, see, then I'm there. I'm in that future right now. I'm going.
But I'm with you guys, and I'm really concerned about the inadvertent gestures. I mean, we already have butt dialing, which doesn't require much of a gesture. at least in the days when we had, you know, when we had push button phones on our phones, you know, we had a lot of that happening. And even today, you know, with touch screens, there's a lot of weird stuff that happens when your touch sensor starts malfunctioning, or you start malfunctioning, or whatever. Yeah. And just, you know, having to not even touch your screen and just hover over to have something happen. That's a bit worrisome. And I do want to say, you know, I did buy an Xbox 360 just to get a Kinect way back when. And quite frankly, I played with it for a month or two, and I thought, oh, this is cool. I can, you know, eat a sandwich and not get things all greasy. But honestly, I never used it after that.
Yeah, and where I saw it in a lot of the games and all the other technologies, the shame was that developers didn't really make good on it. Some of the games my kids loved. The games where it was all Kinect interaction, right. The sports games they had a blast with, and I saw a lot of potential in it. I saw it in, ironically, and it carried over to the Xbox One to the next level. But I again little adoption with exercise and fitness, you know, and being able to have the Kinect monitor your progress, you know, and how you're performing exercises. There's worlds of great potential for this understanding gestures and motion. I just to make a phone easier, not so much.
All righty. Okay, so that was it. I actually do have one more question, but I'll hold it off for our next podcast with you when we come back someday, hopefully soon, Don, and that's what you think about Windows Hello. But we've gone pretty long on this one. And
I have had so much time to sneak around while Don has been distracted and plant so many evil things that he'll be encountering for the rest of his life. That has been productive podcast.
I don't think any of them will ever be able to overcome or surpass your ability to make the house next to mine in Foursquare. turning it into Cobra Command headquarters, and then becoming the mayor of Cobra Command headquarters next door to my house. Of course, people still talk about the humorous exchanges when I started checking in and saying I was bringing, I was bringing over a meatloaf and a welcome cake to Cobra Command. And
there was a day Cobra Command did steal the mayorship of your house briefly.
Yes. Cobra and Command actually invaded. Good
Cobra plots that kind of fizzled very quickly.
Yeah. I still think there are people involved now at Swarm, but there are people sitting in offices associated with Foursquare and Swarm that sit there and must curse us, going all the way back to causing things to crash when they were in beta by checking in as we were driving on the highway to randomly in Seattle at a high rate of speed.
Oh, I remember that.
We were checking into everything that we could find, see how quickly we could check into stuff. And then this kind of activity, I just think our pictures are somewhere up on a wall in their headquarters.
Well,
going,
that's
don't.
Why they turned off the whole checking in mayor thing for a while, right?
Yeah, they had to, they changed the algorithm, how quickly you could check in.
Yeah.
That was because I think we pretty much checked into everything between between Redmond and downtown Seattle. On the highway, I think we managed to check into everything, including people's houses. Yeah. Some wonderful comments about that. We checked in, and comments were good food in the refrigerator.
Yep.
Yeah, everything.
Someone checked into a bathroom at one point. I'm pretty sure.
Yep. So it's I look forward to seeing which neighbor's house that you hijack the next time.
Okay. Alrighty. This has been Movies Podcast number 159. Todd Agosaw, Jen Westfall, with our special guest. Adeem Nazel, otherwise known as Don Sorcinelli. Thank you, Don. Thank you, John. And
thank
we
you.
Will talk to you next time.
Later.
Day.